This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Making dialogue illegal is genocidal. It's one face of it is easy to decipher. It smiles at you, embraces you, and sends out transparent messages. It's the generous face that makes promises of plenitude and life eternal. This is the face that promises the possibility that lives can be conceived of and conducted apart from death. It's a solar face, serene and unproblematic, for nothing is more unproblematic, logically as well as psychologically, than the prospect of life outside death. The other face, instead, is mysterious and ambiguous, difficult to read. It prefers to stay in obscurity. It surrounds itself with an oppressive silence and hardly penetrable pronouncements. Yet, one soon notices that the mysteriousness, obscurity, and impenetrability are too consistent and too stubbornly pursued to be accidental. They are deliberate. They are meant to conceal something to the exact extent that they are meant to reveal something. If one is to come up with a key to understanding this text, this genocide entity, that key should be able to cast light on this complex dialectic of concealment and revelation. The decoding I'm proposing comes from the alchemical tradition. A hint that this might be a good interpretation is dropped at one point in a highly jokingly fashion, how else, in the text itself. It was a philosopher's stone that you were in search of. You wished to brew the elixir of life. Why not take it literally? What if this is not just a way of speaking, but the actual key to the whole thing? I'm using the term alchemy here in a broad, more refined sense. It's the sense in which, for example, Robert Merton, a French scholar of alchemy, uses it. It's something unaffected by time, immemorial, as an art, as a royal and sacerdotal art. In this sense, alchemy does not have a history. Its history being the history of life and death, the history of the resurrection of the universe and of each one of us. In this refined sense, alchemy does not deal with anymore with substances and relations and reactions, but it's above all an exercise in it's above all a philosophical exercise in self-experimenting and self-transcending. One of the fundamental premises on which alchemists base their approach is that there what might be called the perfectibility of being. Things, just as people, can be in a bad shape, weak, or even fallen. However, for an alchemist, their state is never hopeless. Things and people can be cured, healed, taken care of. Alchemy teaches precisely the restorer of all fallen and informed bodies and how to bring them back to the true balance and the best of health. More than that, it's not enough to cure things. They have to be pushed to the maximum of plenitude. They can reach to the point of being able to speak of their resurrection. The body could be cleansed, dismembered, rearranged, or otherwise suitably doctored in preparation for its resurrection, by restoring to it a carefully adjusted balance of ennobling spiritual principles. This is possible for alchemists because, for them, what characterizes nature is an universal drive towards self-overcoming. This is, as an anonymous medieval writer has put it, I must tell you that nature always intends and strives to the perfection of gold. It's tempting, then, to parallel the logical path taken by Arakawawen and Gins with that followed by the alchemists of old. The same concern with the fallen state of a human affairs and the failed need to cure and overcome it is what triggers Arakawa and Gin's approach in the first place. The impetus towards reversible destiny grew up of the total disgust we felt for the human condition and out of endless despairing over the seemingly impossibility of its ever being able to be made into a truly human condition. But then too, and particularly out of a tremendous desire not to live as defeatists. Walking in the alchemist's footsteps, as it were, they realize that the only way human condition can become a truly human condition is by self-overcoming. It's only up to us to be fully human. They could have almost taken literally the Belgian alchemist Gerhard Dorn's advice that, as their maxim, transform yourselves from dead stones into living philosophical stones. The solution that both alchemists and Arakawa and Ginz have come up with is uncompromising. We cannot cure life unless we decide to place it once and forever outside the realm of death. The alchemists did this by equating philosopher's stone with panacea, lapis philosophorum sum medicina universalis. Because the philosopher's stone was also known as the elixir or tincture, and was credited not only with the power of transmuting, but with that of prolonging life indefinitely. For example, in Teatrum Chemicum Britannicum, in one of the poems, there is a mention of the golden oil called aurum potabile, a medicine most marvelous to preserve man's health, and of transmutation the greatest can be. Arakawa and Ginz, in their turn, do this by designing specific procedures, alchemists will call them operations, through which death can be tricked and left outside the human possibilities. It's only through following these procedures that we can flourish, self-create, and become who we are. What needs to be firmly guaranteed above all else, is the right of the person to self-create and blossom forth as an architectural body. These procedures, be it said in passing, can be sometimes about performing very simple things, like breaking the spell of death, the culture of having to die we ourselves have imposed on us. All species will, by means of architectural procedures, release itself from the stranglehold that its own culture has on it. As a result, death will never be able to catch up with us, simply because we'll not have a name for it. Should anyone ever raise doubts about the feasibility of the project in the name of common sense or some other lame excuse, nothing would be easier for Arakawa and Ginz than to point silently to Paracelsus, who treated common sense as it deserved. We will enterprise this work, wherein we shall help all infirmities whose cure to the opinionated and presumptuous physicists do seem impossible. But that which is greater to preserve and keep mortal man to a long, sound, and perfect age. The equivalent of the alchemist's great works, of the great work of Opus Magnum, which is the glorious culmination of the entire transmuting process, is, in Arakawa and Ginz, our becoming architects overnight. The spectacular inner transmutation that the alchemists talk about in their writings has become, in their case, our increased ability to perform miraculously, in the absence of a specialized training, the type of architectural procedures required for not dying. Use the forming power that you are amassing, an avalanche of skillfully applied know-how, to grow more widely confident of your ability to assemble and an architectural procedure, and presto, become an architect in earnest. It should not be viewed as preposterous that we have overnight become an architect. Arakawa and Ginz's opus magnum, once accomplished, will bring about a new culture of creativity and self-creation, self-realization. This new society will be a society of artists and self-creators. This would be a time of cosmic posthuman creativity, something different from all we know about creativity. Every citizen may speak, write, and print, invent, and assemble architectural procedures for tactically proposed surrounds, and participate in the design of closely argued built discourses, both on this planet and, if possible, intergalactically. No wonder, then, that Paul Celan's verses that there are songs to sing behind the human emerge at this point in Making Die Illegal. Seeking and inventing songs beyond the human is exactly what this project is about. Finally, another important factor in an alchemical reading of making dye illegal is the language. The book is written in a language of its own. Le Cercle, in his illuminating introduction, noticed among the most conspicuous characteristics of this language the absence of punctuation, an elevated diction, the use of paradox, the typical Beckettian repetitiveness and through exhaustion of logical possibilities. Arakawa and Ginz redefine old terms and coin new ones, break old rules and invent new ones. The language they use is, to a significant extent, deliberately hermetic, hieratic, and invocatory. There is something priestly about the way they use they use language. In their hands, language comes to perform new functions. Sometimes, one of the basic functions of language is, of course, as traditionally defined, to communicate. Sometimes, however, like in this case, the role of language is to not communicate, to prevent the reader, the unfit reader, from occupying and inhabiting the text. Through repetition, hieratic pronouncements, and a sophisticated wave of new concepts, Arakawa and Ginz create a protective screen between their work and the potential aggressiveness of the outside world. It's as though they are to guard their text against any inappropriate and unprepared readership. This is not unlike what happens in alchemy. Alchemy, too, belongs to the same long tradition in Western thought that important truths are most properly expressed in a veiled, obscure, and difficult way. In alchemy, to keep any invasive readership away, difficult concepts are sometimes explained not through less difficult concepts, but the other way around. The obscure by the even more obscure, the unknown by the even more unknown. Alchemists, too, redefine the terms they use and make sure that they increase, not decrease, the obscurity. What they mean by certain words is not what everybody else does. Our mercury is not the mercury of the common people. On the whole, alchemist's characteristic discursive practice is to express its truth is in binary figures of language, paradox, enigma, equivocation, and allegories, which say one thing and mean another. Its characteristic choice of rhetorical tropes mimes its ideological belief in an universe in which matter itself is mysteriously instinct with life. The employment of paradoxical and seemingly nonsensical pronouncements is one of the main rhetorical techniques in making dialing illegal. It's a fell. For Arakawa and Ginz, as Le Clercq puts it, paradox is the site of truth and nonsense the origin of meaning. Certain things have to be said in a paradoxical manner, not because of the author's whimsical tastes, but simply because that would be the only way to express them adequately, to do them justice. The more paradoxical or nonsensical they may seem, the better chances are that they can express something. They can say at some point, the argument can be seen to smack of circularity. That it does so, we hasten to declare, makes it more, not less convincing. Through coinage of new terminology, linguistic and the use of ambiguity and paradox, the authors make room for the extraordinary. This book is precisely about that. Thinking out, conceiving of the extraordinary, creating the conditions of possibility for the extraordinary things to happen. We need to prepare ourselves to understand and receive the extraordinary. Otherwise, extraordinary things might happen to us and we would not even notice them. Reversible destiny, just like Lapis Philosophorum, is such an extraordinary thing. It's extraordinary not because it's impossible, who knows, but because, ordinarily, we don't know how to receive it. To the extent that, even if such a thing would happen, we would be too blinded by our attachment to the common path to recognize it, which would give us enough reason to die of shame. Arakawa and Ginz, just like the alchemists of old, are among the few to show this to us. They are to be thanked for reminding us that it's only up to us to see and recognize the extraordinary. That's what makes their project precious. I only have one piece of friendly advice to give them at the end of this talk. Be careful. Watch out. Learn what you have to from the true story that follows. One alchemist complained that falling under this suspicion that he had discovered the elixir vitae because he had happened to effect some rather spectacular cures during an epidemic, he had to disguise himself, shave off his beard, and put on a wig before he was able to escape, after a false name, from a mob howling for his elixir. Thank you.